Well, this is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. And in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about cancer, about the experience of cancer, about living with it, living through it, and about the interest that so many people have in trying to combine therapies, to use conventional medical therapies, but also look for the possibilities of alternatives that can help. One of the things that we know is that if you ask people who have had cancer about their experience, they often talk about the places that they go for treatment, and they say that these places can sometimes be sterile and harsh and scary. And sometimes they even describe their doctors in that same way. For that reason, for the reason that they're looking for a kind of a care that considers the whole person. Often people have gone, and we're talking here about millions of people, they have gone in searching for alternative practitioners. The problem there, however, is that these folks sometimes are not in a position to offer good advice about conventional treatments. In this hour, we'll be talking with Dr. Jeremy Geffen. He is a board-certified medical oncologist. He's a physician who specializes in dealing with cancer, who has become well-known as someone who works to try to bring together both of these approaches, both the mainstream conventional Western medicine approach and the alternative. And he says, in fact, that it is possible to combine the benefits of both of those things. He is the author of a book that was first published in 2000 and has recently been published in an updated version. The book is entitled The Journey Through Cancer, Healing and Transforming the Whole Person. That is the subtitle. It's published by Three Rivers Press. It's available on paperback, is not terribly expensive. So if you're experiencing cancer or someone that is important to you is, it'd be the kind of thing that you could take a look at and get some benefit from, I think. Just again to mention our guest, Dr. Jeremy Geffen, he's a pioneer. Many people consider him to be a pioneer in the field of integrative medicine. He is the founder of Geffen Visions International Incorporated. And if you're interested in finding out about that, you can go to their website, which is geffenvisions.com. He founded the Geffen Cancer Center and Research Institute in Vero Beach, Florida, which he directed until 2003. And this was one of the first places in the country explicitly designed to provide a working model of a truly holistic, comprehensive cancer care. So if you have questions as we move along here through the hour, they're certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can call us. Dr. Geffen, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Very welcome.
We
appreciate
it.
To be with you.
I suppose whenever we talk about cancer, there is something of a good news, bad news situation. Good in the sense that our ability to treat cancer has improved, but bad in the sense that it is still very, very common, and the chances that an individual will be diagnosed with cancer in his or her life are really startlingly high.
Yeah, that's to say the least. To say the least. I mean, the numbers are pretty compelling. You know, it's now estimated that one in three people alive in our country today are going to be diagnosed with cancer at some point in their lifetime. And, I mean, that's a statistic that really ought to get everyone's attention.
Now, I was thinking about that, though, and if you... when you do that in the aggregate, that's a really staggering number. Mm-hmm. But if you break it down and you say, well, skin cancer is very common, for example, and very survivable. So if we kind of cut that out, and if we concentrate particularly on cancers that are really difficult to treat and that perhaps are more likely to affect people over, say, the age of 50, does that really change things very much?
You know, it's a good question. I need to check the numbers, but, you know, my understanding is that number is excluding the skin cancers, you know.
Oh, okay.
And you're right. It's not as if you can look around today and, you know, in a room and say in the next year one out of every three people will get cancer. But over the course of a lifetime, those numbers are real. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And That's the bad news, and as you pointed out, the good news is there's actually quite a lot that people can begin to do today to really improve their risk, lower their odds of getting cancer. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a tremendous amount that people can do to increase their chances of surviving cancer, particularly through screening and early detection.
Well, perhaps we could talk, let's just talk about prevention for a moment.
Okay.
And because there certainly are things that people can do or things that they should not do that can contribute to their either their cut down their chances of developing cancer or predispose them. And the one thing that springs to mind immediately is smoking. One of the things that we know is that there that if you smoke, it will significantly increase your risk of lung cancer. And so one of the basic pieces of advice we give is don't smoke, or
right.
If you smoke now, quit. So that's a pretty easy, straightforward, sort of straight line thing. We can say, yeah, we're pretty sure that smoking is bad, so don't. But other than that, is there anything on the general side that one can say about here are some things that we would suggest that you do, and if you do these things, it will reduce, you know, we can't give any guarantees, but it will reduce your chances of developing cancer?
Sure. Ironically, David, it's not that complicated. It's actually pretty simple, and it's pretty intuitive as well. And, you know, the major groups of things you can do are as follows. First of all, as you said, clearly the number one thing that people, you know, can do is just stop smoking. And some people believe that if everybody stopped smoking, we'd cut the number of, you know, cases of cancer by a third and death by cancer by a third overnight. It would just immediately start that trend downward. Beyond that, believe it or not, alcohol is a risk factor for, you know, increases the risk of certain cancers. So drinking more than a glass or two of wine a day, and even that's somewhat controversial, but, you know, certainly people ought to just be aware that alcohol, too, is a risk factor, and that should be reduced. Beyond that, believe it or not, exercise and maintaining a healthy body weight is extremely important. Obesity is a risk factor for cancer. So quitting smoking, cutting down alcohol, exercising, maintaining a proper, healthy body weight, all these things are very important. And then finally, there's the role of diet and nutrition. And this is a hotbed of controversy because it seems that every couple of years there's a big study that says that, a particular kind of food or fat, you know, is associated with cancer risk. And then 2 years later, there's another study that contradicts it. So it's a bit controversial, but there is a very clear consensus that eating a diet that is predominantly based on lots of healthy fruits and vegetables which contain substances that are called antioxidants is extremely helpful over the long term. Avoiding fatty foods, greasy fatty foods, is extremely important. Avoiding a lot of animal fat and animal products. And also, there's some data that suggests that meat, when it's grilled and burned, you know, can contain compounds that are carcinogenic. So it's pretty simple. Eat a really good, balanced diet, drink plenty of water, eat lots of fruits and vegetables, avoid fatty foods, processed, refined foods, sugars, avoid alcohol and cigarettes, and exercise, and maintain a good healthy body weight, and you're going to dramatically lower your risk of cancer. Added to that, really become educated about how to take advantage of screening tests, and it's quite substantial how people can help themselves and their loved ones, and it's mm-hmm. pretty simple.
And probably if you followed that regimen, you'd also go some way to reducing your risk of heart disease and diabetes and stroke and a bunch of other stuff.
Absolutely. And you know, there'll be a lot less sadness and depression. You know, if people were exercising and feeling good about themselves, not only would they reduce their risk of cancer and heart disease, but they're going to have a much healthier, much more vibrant life and more fulfilling life. And that's, by the way, the real focus of my book, The Journey Through Cancer, which is to transform the way we think about this experience from being almost like a penance or a death sentence or something to be endured into a journey of self-discovery that can help people really live fulfilled and fulfilling and empowered and passionate lives while they're on this journey. and give themselves the very best chance of living a long time, too.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about what is in the book. Let me just ask you one more quick question,
sure,
following up on what you were just talking about, and that is, under the heading of diet and nutrition, I think that there are some people who would argue that in addition to trying to get your antioxidants through the food that you eat, some people argue for supplementing. Do you think that that is at all useful?
Well, again, it's very controversial. There's never been really compelling, conclusive studies that show that taking antioxidant supplements or vitamin supplements significantly reduce the risk of cancers. You know, there's some very, very, you know, intriguing data in a couple of areas, like, you know, does selenium help reduce prostate cancer risk, and a couple of things like that. But, you know, fundamentally, none of these are home runs. None of these are you know, magic bullets or silver bullets. And so, again, the most clearly helpful thing is to eat really good fruits and vegetables and eat a healthy diet and exercise and drink plenty of water. I personally advocate people taking a really good multivitamin a couple of times a day and talk with their practitioner about what additional supplements might be helpful for them. But the real reason to do that, David, is not to try specifically to avoid cancer, but it's to be healthy and to make sure that your body's getting all the nutrition that it needs. Because it's very easy in the culture that we live in today to walk around with, you know, chronic low-grade malnutrition just because we eat so many processed foods.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me introduce again the guest for this hour, Dr. Geffen. He is a board-certified medical oncologist. He is a physician who specializes in dealing with cancer. He's a pioneer in the field of integrative medicine and is the founder of Geffen Visions International Incorporated. He is also the author of a book, The Journey Through Cancer, first published in 2000 and now revised and updated in a new edition. It's published in paperback by Three Rivers Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about how you became interested in alternative therapies. I know you explained in the book that you you studied medicine in the conventional way and are, in fact, a mainstream doctor, medical doctor. And yet you also became interested in the possibility that other kinds of medical philosophies or treatment regimens or different kinds of medicine other than the Western medicine that you studied, interested that in those things and what they could bring to the table, so to speak. And I know that it's also something that there are physicians like you who are interested in anything, you know, trying anything that would work. And then there are other physicians, I think, that are very skeptical.
Sure.
Because it's for some of these things, it's hard to find really hard data that will satisfy the Western scientific mind that there are some of these things that work. How is it that you got interested in exploring these things and trying to put the two together?
Well, thanks for asking. I was a curious fellow growing up, and in my teenage years, I became very interested in Eastern religions and philosophies. And when I was 19 years old, I met a spiritual teacher, and she was teaching yoga and meditation and had a community, a spiritual community called an ashram, and I decided I wanted to drop out of school, and I did actually drop out of college for 4 years. You know, my parents, God bless them, they almost had a heart attack when they did that, but they really supported me through this, and I spent 4 years studying the great spiritual and healing traditions of the East, particularly Hinduism and Buddhism, and learned about yoga and meditation, became a vegetarian, lived a cleansing diet for several years with my community, and I saw just the incredible power, healing potential of eating really healthy raw food diet and how people can go through deep cleansing experiences. And I was just in love with these traditions, but I had a deep calling in my heart to become a doctor. I wanted to live in the world. I wanted to understand how my body worked, how drugs and surgery worked, and I wanted to make a contribution as a physician and a healer. And so I left the community after 4 years and went to college at Columbia University in New York and NYU Medical School in New York City and dove very deeply into the Western medical model and traditions and loved what I was learning there as well. But I recognized pretty early on that, you know, the Western model is very mechanical, and it focuses on the disease, on the pathology reports, on the blood tests, you know, very often, frankly, ignoring the fact that there's a human being connected to these blood tests and CAT scans and path reports. And it's almost as if the person didn't matter. And this was really troubling to me because I knew that, you know, behind every CAT scan or path report or biopsy specimen, there's a human being who has a mind and a heart and a soul and a spirit, as well as a body, who also has hopes and dreams and a family and, you know, and fears and concerns. And I wanted to find a more holistic way to do this. And so I started traveling to the East, and in med school I went on an expedition to Nepal and was quite amazed. This was back in 1986. Was quite amazed to discover the healing traditions of Asia not only had a lot to offer people on a spiritual level, but things like Ayurvedic medicine from India and Tibetan medicine from Tibet and Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine. These traditions also had very powerful ways of helping the physical body to heal. So I became really focused like a laser beam on trying to find ways to integrate these in a way that was safe and effective and ethical and that made sense. Certainly, you know, my foundation is in Western medicine, and especially for cancer, I have to say, you know, for the record, I really have seen the power and the scope of what oncology, you know, traditional cancer medicines can do for people. But you don't have to be in this field very long, David, to recognize that there are also a lot of limitations. And while Western medicine can do a lot of good for a lot of people, there are many, many people that are not cured and for which our treatments are not very effective. And so we've got to be open-minded. We've got to look beyond, you know, just what's in front of us and explore all therapies that can help people heal.
Well, we have callers to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? And we'll start here with this person, and they're listening in Champaign, and they're on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Earlier, you've talked about healthy diet and its importance in overall health and whatnot. Do you think that eating organic food makes any difference? And if yes, then why? That would be it.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
So the question, as I understood it, is eating organic food make a difference?
Right.
I think the obvious answer is, you know, yes, eating really healthy food is going to help us be healthier. Now, whether I can say, you know, honestly that it's eating organic broccoli versus inorganic broccoli or organic chicken versus inorganic chicken is going to lower one's risk for cancer, I can't say that with any, you know, based on any scientific proof. But on an intuitive level, it just makes sense that the healthier food you put in the body, the stronger the body will be, stronger the immune system will be. And whether that really lowers an individual's specific risk for cancer, I don't know, because cancer is a multifactorial disease. It's caused by, you know, it has many, many causes, all of which are interacting simultaneously, and diet is certainly one of them. But we have to be honest and recognize that some people can eat really, really lousy food, and they live to be 100. Other people eat incredibly healthy food, and I've had a lot of these patients in my practice over the years. I mean, literally people who'd never taken an aspirin in their lives, they were vegans and yoga teachers, and they also got cancer. And so to only focus on the diet, in my opinion, is missing the bigger picture. Diet's a very important thing, but it's only one of many important things.
One thing I'd like to have you talk about is I suppose this is assuming that an individual has the luxury of being able to choose their physician.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody has a wide range of choice, and if they have the diagnosis of cancer, then who's going to treat them, who's going to do the surgery, they may not have a lot of choice. But assuming that they do have the opportunity to exercise some choice, how would you suggest people think about making that choice and who their doctor is going to be?
Well, I'm also glad you asked that question, and I wrote about this in my book. You know, it's very important, in my opinion, that when you're dealing with cancer specifically, that you do your best to find an oncologist that that really has two qualities. First of all, that is medically very well trained and skilled, that really knows what they're doing, has experience in the particular kind of cancer that you have or your loved one has, and also that has an infrastructure, a practice, a facility, a hospital that they work with, so that if, you know, God forbid, you get sick and there's problems, they have the capacity and the facilities to really take good care of you. So the medical part is primary, you know, for most people. At the same time, I also think it's equally important to try to find a physician that you feel cares about you as a human being, that has genuine kindness and love and compassion in their heart, and especially that is willing and capable of answering your questions. One of the things that doctors hear so much from patients and that I heard over and over and over again is, you know, my doctor just won't answer my questions, they're too busy. They get angry at me when I ask questions, and that's really not a good scenario. Now, one of the reasons that I wrote my book, The Journey Through Cancer, is because as my practice grew and grew over the years, it became literally impossible for me to take care of all the patients who wanted me to be their physician, and I realized that so many of the issues and concerns that people were dealing with were universal. They were common to all of us. They're part of our common human heritage, if you will. And so I wrote this book to try to address those questions and concerns for all the people in the country and around the world who are going through the journey through cancer, who want a guidebook that can show them all the specific areas where they need to put their focus and their attention. Even if their own doctor is not pointing them there, they can have confidence that this book will show them exactly what they need to focus on, and how they can find resources from multiple areas to supplement perhaps what their specific physician is able to give them.
Mm-hmm. I think if you ask people about their healthcare and ask them about the things that they're happy about and the things that they're unhappy about, I think it's true to say that one of the things that people complain about most, and you touched on it, was the feeling that they don't have the time and the opportunity to have some kind of relationship with their physician to the point where they feel that their doctor knows them, you know, knows who they are as a person. And I think that seems to be one of the problems that goes with managed care. It may be that the doctor doesn't have a very good bedside manner, but it may also be that the doctor is probably as frustrated as the patient about the limitations on his or her time. They have a lot of patients. They're limited as to how much time they can spend with the patient. And it's a difficult situation, and I'm sure that both patients and doctors would wish that things were different. What do you do about that? And particularly if you feel that you're being rushed, you're not getting as much of the doctor's time, and that the doctor is not maybe being as responsive to you and your concerns as you would like.
Well, if you are in an HMO, and you know millions of people are in an HMO, it's important to recognize that, you know, my understanding of the law in almost every state that I'm aware of, you know, mandates that even if you're in an HMO, you're entitled to a second opinion. And I think that's just a fundamental human right that even people in HMOs are entitled to. And if you're not, then that's a really scary proposition. But first of all, patients should know that it's normal and it's appropriate to ask for a second opinion, even if you're in an HMO. I've worked with many, many people in HMOs, and very often they were surprised to find out that they could, in fact, ask for a second or sometimes even a third opinion, or ask to be seen by another physician or oncologist in the group, and that's appropriate and normal, and they shouldn't hesitate or feel ashamed or concerned or worried about asking for that. That's number one. Obviously, if you're not in an HMO, if you're in a different kind of a insurance plan, by all means, get a second opinion or even a third until you find the doctor that you feel can answer your questions. Now, you're exactly right, David, that this healthcare system that we have is incredibly frustrating, not only to patients, but to physicians. And I can speak as an oncologist, having worked in this field for many years, you know, I can report to you that doctors have never been as frustrated and unhappy historically as they are now in this profession. And, you know, there's a lot of political and economic reasons for that, why the healthcare system looks the way it does now. I don't know that we should open that Pandora's box on this radio interview today, because it's a long discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, and this is the healthcare system we have. And at least people can know, who are listening today, that there are lots of sources for help and support and guidance. And if you can't get everything that you would want from your physician, it's okay as long as you're getting good medical care. And if he won't answer or she won't answer your questions, get my book, The Journey Through Cancer. You'll find a lot of answers there. And even in the back of my book, there are four appendices that have dozens and dozens of pages of websites and books and audio programs and resources and cancer support organizations that are ready and willing right now and able to help provide guidance and information and reassurance and comfort and support. So we live at a time when it's kind of like, you know, the agony and the ecstasy. You know, on the one hand, things are very, very challenging for a lot of people. At the same time, there's more information and support available today than ever before.
Well, let me just take the opportunity here to introduce again our guest, Dr. Jeremy Geffen. He is a board-certified medical oncologist. He's a pioneer in the field of integrative medicine. He's the founder of Geffen Visions International, Incorporated, and they do have a website, which is www.geffenvisions.com, if you're interested in finding out more about them. He was the founder of the Geffen Cancer Center and Research Institute in Vero Beach, Florida, which he directed until 2003. It was one of the first cancer centers in the U.S. explicitly designed to provide a working model of holistic, comprehensive cancer care. And he has authored a book, which has recently been published in a new, revised, and updated edition. The book is The Journey Through Cancer, Healing and Transforming the Whole Person, and it is published by Three Rivers Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone in Chicago to talk with, line number 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm calling up about some information that reported about detection of cancer, you know. And it seems that they thought that animals such as cats and dogs have been able to be beneficial in detection of cancer. I was wondering if your guests could comment on that.
Sure. There were some recent studies that described how dogs, which have an amazing capacity to detect and to differentiate different scents, could actually sniff out cancer, if you will. I mean, quite literally, they could tell which cells had cancer, which people had cancer versus which didn't. So these are very provocative studies. I haven't studied them in great detail, but I certainly was aware of them. And, it's very intriguing. Now, I'm not, you know, frankly, ready at this point to advocate that we start dogs to help us determine who has cancer or not, but we got to be open-minded. There may be circumstances where, you know, that can help us. I think there are a lot of things that we can do, some of which we've been talking about, that will really, really help people. And there really is an important point to make here about early detection and cancer screening. And there are very well-defined guidelines for people that are published primarily by the American Cancer Society. They talk about very basic, simple things that people can do, like women should get mammograms, you know, starting at the age of 50. Men around the same age, except African-American men, might even want to start for prostate cancer screening even before 50, you know, with a digital rectal exam and at least a yearly PSA test, a blood test for prostate cancer. You know, people should get a colonoscopy. Screening colonoscopy has saved many, many, many lives. And, you know, Katie Couric has done so much to educate the culture about that and the importance of colonoscopy. And if you're, you know, at high risk for lung cancer, if you've been a smoker for a long time, talk to your doctor and see what, you know, whether or not it'd be appropriate for you to get a CAT scan or an X-ray. And there are a lot of things like this that are very simple that can yield tremendous benefits for people.
All right. I think the caller would like to follow up on his question.
There's also another area of treatment. I was wondering if you touched upon it in your book regarding magnets. Certain claims have been made as to, some early forms of cancer of the skin, say, mm-hmm. or other things where magnets have been instrumental in some treatment.
Well, I tell you, if you type in alternative cancer treatments into a search engine, you know, like Google, you will be amazed at the hundreds of thousands of websites that come up. People have tried everything throughout history to cure cancer, everything from magnets and crystals and wheatgrass juice and raw diet and Essiac tea and mistletoe. And, the list goes on and on. I've discussed quite a lot of those in my book, Shark Cartilage. You know, the challenge is that it's very hard to know which ones really work. Obviously, part of the problem is it's hard to get funding to do really well-controlled studies. I mean, I'll admit that. There is a bias in the mainstream medical community that almost scoffs at anything other than chemotherapy or surgery or radiation.
Or even, touching upon the possible benefits of homeopathy and some forms of health treatments. Yeah,
I mean, I totally understand. You know, I was trained in that world, and I spent many years practicing in that world, so I understand the cultural bias. It's almost as if all those therapies are dismissed out of hand, as if there's no possible way they could ever do anything because, you know, they're regarded as ridiculous. I would, you know, always love the story of Galileo. And people in his time were burned at the stake if they even suggested that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Going around the sun.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that gets, I think, to a very important question, and that is, if you take a look at all of the therapies that come under the great umbrella of alternative or complementary medicine, as you say, that there are so many you hardly can't count.
Right.
Now, then also, though, there are, if you place these things on a kind of a continuum, along a line of, let us say, most accepted by mainstream medicine and least accepted, you can do that, but still, I guess my bottom line question is, are there particular kinds of alternative complementary therapies that you feel that there is good evidence for being helpful, and what would they be?
Well, I also discuss this, you know, in some detail in my book. And what I've learned, you know, I was in practice for about, 11 years running this integrative cancer center. And we had people come from all over the country, all over the world, who had tried just about everything you can imagine. And I've got to tell you, in my personal experience, you know, I did not see a lot of success stories from people with alternative therapies. Now, obviously, there's a certain, you know, logic to that, because the success stories wouldn't come to me anyway. I believe that there are some individuals sometimes that are helped by radical changes in their diet, for example, or by drinking, you know, wheatgrass juice or coffee enemas. You know, anything conceivably can help some people some of the time. The issue is, what is out there that works most consistently and most reliably for the most people? So what I try to advise people to do is to, first of all, make sure that they understand the benefits of mainstream medicine. Know and understand what the strengths are, what the limits are for your particular cancer. There's a lot of cancers that can be readily cured with mainstream medicine, and it is a crying shame for people to avoid that. And I've seen, frankly, many, many people die, go to their graves, because they had very rigid beliefs about, you know, I'm not going to take chemotherapy, or I'm not going to have surgery. I can cure this, you know, with plants or diets. And I watched many people sadly die when they could have been cured. At the same time, there's a lot of people that have cancers that Western medicine admittedly cannot cure. And I think it's very hard to tell a human being that has a kind of cancer that we don't have really good curative treatments for, you know, to shame them or blame them if they want to explore alternative options. And so I think we need to be compassionate and open-minded and put ourselves in other people's shoes and say, hey, man, how would I feel if it was me? And in that circumstance, there's a lot of things that people can do to help themselves. I tend to think of the whole world of complementary and alternative medicine as having a proper role of strengthening the physical body, detoxifying, cleansing the body, rather than working as a direct anti-cancer agent. Cancer can be pretty virulent, and very often, you know, trying to use herbs and supplements against cancers, like, you know, using a squirt gun on a bonfire, you need a big fire hydrant with water, and that's where these big guns, chemo, and radiation can really be life-saving at times. So they've got to be used with skill. They've got to be used with wisdom. They've got to be used with kindness and great, great care. And in the context of a philosophy that says we're not really here to treat cancer, we're here to take care of people, human beings, and we've got to honor their mind and their heart and their soul and their spirit, as well as take care of their body.
Well, this I think this gets at a question about when you talk about complementary, and I know, again, I want to underscore the fact that you were trained in conventional Western mainstream medicine, and as you say, you believe in the power of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, the mainstream kind of medical stuff.
I believe. Let me just clarify. I know its power. I've seen it countless times, but only in certain circumstances. That Western medicine, chemo, radiation, surgery, are unbelievably powerful in some circumstances and not in others. So it's not a blanket statement. We have to have the honesty and the humility to admit that, you know, we are phenomenally strong and capable in certain cancers, and we're very, very weak in others. So it's not a blanket statement, and this is where the wisdom and the intelligence comes in, and the humility to be able to say, you know, in those circumstances where we cannot readily or reliably cure a person's cancer, let's be open-minded and see what else we can do to help them. Let's look at other cultures like Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine and Tibetan medicine. These people have been working on this for thousands of years. You know, Western medicine's only really, 100 or 200 years old. And what I've seen on my travels in Asia are some remarkable, remarkable things. Again, the problem is it takes a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of motivation to be able to document and prove exactly what those benefits are. So people need to be careful.
It goes without saying that cancer is hard on the body. So are surgery, radiation, and chemo. I guess when I'm thinking, wondering is, when you take a look at alternative or complementary kinds of therapies, is it the case that some of these therapies actually have, in the pharmacological sense, a therapeutic effect, and that it acts against the cancer? Or is it more the case that some of these things can make people feel better, so that helps, and then possibly also strengthen their bodies, so that then the natural kind of healing mechanisms that people have, whatever kind of natural cancer-fighting mechanisms the body might have, that they might actually be bolstered, so that it's either a, you know, is it a kind of a direct thing, or is it something that's a little bit more indirect? But if it makes you feel better, then that's good. If you can do something that at the very least makes people feel better, that's a good thing.
Well, I think it's the latter. I think that again, in my experience, and it's not insignificant experience, and I've been really focusing like a laser beam on this field for, almost 20 years, there is very little reliable evidence that, eating a raw food diet is going to cure metastatic breast cancer or lung cancer or any other cancer for that matter. That's not to say that occasionally there are people who do this who have what would appear to be miraculous, incredibly unexpected positive responses. I've seen those cases too, but they're the exception, not the rule. So I'd like to point out, though, David, that cancer ultimately, like many things in life, is a mystery. And there's a mystery to who gets well and who doesn't. And we have to be, we have to have a little bit of humility and remember that there's a lot that we know about cancer, even on a molecular or genetic level, and there is so much that we don't know. One of the things that's becoming evident in research in the last number of years is that even the genetic variations among different people with what we would call the same kind of cancer, these genetic variations can be very dramatic. So you can have two women with breast cancer that looks identical under the microscope, and they both have stage 1 or stage 2 breast cancer, infiltrating ductal cancer, and yet they're, so you'd expect them to have the same kind of clinical course, but genetically their tumors are very different. They behave completely differently. So one woman would go to a healer, and her cancer has a genetic configuration that basically makes it very unlikely that it will ever metastasize or recur. And that woman will eat a wheatgrass juice diet or a whole food diet. Her cancer will never come back, and she'll swear to God that she was cured by wheatgrass juice. And the next woman will do the same thing, and her cancer obviously will come back because there's a genetic component that makes it much more lethal. And these are the kinds of stories that you hear all the time. So it underscores the fact that there's a lot that we know about cancer, but there's, you know, if we're really intellectually honest, there's even more we don't know. And by the way, we haven't even touched on the deep intrapsychic component of cancer. What's going on deep in the heart and the mind and the psyche of people, and how the mind can affect the body, and how people can have parts of themselves that are deeply wounded and deeply unconscious that may even not, you know, that may be ambivalent, let's say, about getting well. And so, you know, I've seen this very often. People sometimes can be suffering, and even though their family or their culture says, you know, you should fight your disease, there's a part of them that is tired and frustrated with life and may not wholeheartedly even want to live. And so there are all these intrapsychic emotional parts of the puzzle, too, that are very important to look at beyond, you know, we've got to expand our focus beyond just focusing on the physical body and on their diets and to recognize, as I said earlier, that we're multidimensional beings. We have a mind, a heart, a soul, a spirit, and a physical body. All of these things are very complex, and they're interwoven. So it's I think simplistic to focus only on diets and supplements, just as it's simplistic to only focus on chemo and surgery. We want to include all these things in a logical and an intelligent way, in an empowering way, and in an honest way. But look deeper into the whole person, and that's what my book, The Journey Through Cancer, is all about. It shows how do you do this in the context of modern medicine, in the context of modern life, wherever you are today, whatever your diagnosis is, whatever your circumstances are, here's a guidebook that can show you all, you know, what I've learned over 20 years about guiding people through this maze of cancer so they can have the very best outcome.
Well, this, you touch on here another question that I had, and that was, and this is obviously a kind of a big and sweeping sort of a thing, but to what extent the person's attitude, maybe just at the basic level of whether they feel they're going to survive or they're going to die, makes a difference in how successful the treatment is and the possibility indeed that they will survive. Do we have some good reason to believe that the mindset, and if a person just says, I'm going to live, and that's that, makes a big difference. There's a big difference between that person and the person when they first receive the diagnosis of cancer, takes that as a death sentence.
Well, you know, great question. Huge subject. What I would tell you from my own experience is that I think that what's really going on mentally and emotionally for people makes an enormous difference. Now, whether it will take somebody from having a curable or an incurable cancer to making it curable, I don't think I can say, and I don't think anyone can say. But if a human being is dealing with cancer and they've got grief and pain and sadness in their heart, that is affecting their physical body. And what I've seen in our cancer center and in the program called the 7 Levels of Healing, which I describe in my book, and in the retreats and workshops that I've led for people and the training courses for people with cancer on the 7 Levels of Healing, what I've seen is that when we address all the needs and concerns of a person, including the mental, including the emotional, including the spiritual, as well as the physical and the dietary and the supplementary concerns, you know, I've seen amazing, astonishing, beautiful results. And, you know, eventually, hopefully, we'll be able to study this in randomized trials, scientifically based studies that can really tease out the details of what's doing what. I'd also like to add, though, something that's very often overlooked, David, and when you talk about the power of the mind, it's important to mention that, you know, as Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung showed us, and as psychologists have shown us since that time, there is a conscious mind and then there's an unconscious mind. And so we all have parts of our mind that we're aware of, thoughts and beliefs and meanings that we give to events that are affecting our physiology and our emotions every single minute. But every human being also has an unconscious mind, deep-rooted feelings, fears, and concerns that are buried underneath consciousness. We're not aware of them. By definition, that's what unconscious means. And those affect the body as well, and sometimes even more. And so it takes a lot of skill and kindness and wisdom and compassion to help bring out the unconscious thoughts and beliefs so they can be released, and also, you know, so that people can be freed from their effects on the body.
Well, this, you know, I hear what you're saying, and I can imagine, though, some of your fellow oncologists saying, it took me a long time to get board certified in oncology. You're talking about a completely different field for which I was not trained. If I had wanted to be a psychiatrist,
right,
I could have become one. But I took this other path, and I hear what you're saying, and I respect, and I think that's probably there's something to that. But how do I do that? That's not what I was taught how to do in med school.
Absolutely. And my response to that is, to oncologists, to my colleagues, is, fair enough. You know, I understand. It takes years and years of training to become a board-certified oncologist, and I know because I went through the whole training. So, you know, we don't need to have one person do everything. This is where developing a multidisciplinary team comes in. Recommend my book, you know, The Journey Through Cancer. It's a full-fledged, comprehensive guide to this whole terrain. And we talked about this earlier. People don't want to necessarily try to get everything from one doctor or one physician. You want to bring a team together so you have a really good medical oncologist that knows what they're doing medically, at least that's open-minded and a caring human being. And if they're honest and open-minded, they'll say, you know, I don't know about that so much, but I'm willing to talk to you about it. Get yourself a therapist. Get yourself hooked up with a counselor that can help heal the emotional part of this. Get involved in support groups, which is level 2 of the 7 levels of healing, called connection with others. Get yourself hooked up with some acupuncturists or Reiki therapists or nutrition experts, and learn about cleansing and detoxifying your body. It's a good idea to, you know, consider learning about your mind and maybe take a meditation class to begin to have some freedom from what I call the tyranny of the mind, which can literally keep people up all night long so they never get a moment of sleep. And everybody who's human has had that experience at least once. And believe me, when you have cancer, it can be a predominant part of your life. And so in this way, by pulling together a multidisciplinary team, you don't have to put all your eggs in one basket. And that's what I try to show people how to do in the journey through cancer.
I know we're almost out of time here, but one of the things that I know is that there are places, clinics, hospitals, where they're interested in pursuing this integrative approach, and that they do just what you have said. It's a team of people that they come together. They look at particular cases. They might have 3, 4, 5 different people who have different areas of expertise. And for each person, the question is, what can I bring to this person?
Right.
And I guess my question is, do you think that as time goes along, that in more places they will start to look at maybe that kind of multi-interdisciplinary approach?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. You know, the genie has been, or the proverbial genie has been let out of this proverbial bottle. I don't think there's any possible way that we're going to turn back. Millions of people, as you started our interview today by pointing out, millions of people in this country and around the world are looking for an approach to medicine that is more sensitive, more compassionate, more attentive to their needs as a whole person. Very few people really want to abandon mainstream medicine or abandon the benefits that it can provide, but most people want to be touched and cared for in a way that's much more holistic. And I think that, you know, the numbers speak for themselves. The millions of people spending billions of dollars, mostly out of pocket, for these services have really caught the attention of mainstream healthcare. And the American Medical Association and the American Society of Clinical Oncology, these organizations are acutely aware of this driving need and desire, and are trying to develop, hopefully, programs that are ethical and meaningful and that really meet the needs and concerns of people in a way that we all want and deserve.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. The book, if you'd like to read it, is The Journey Through Cancer, Healing and Transforming the Whole Person, published by Three Rivers Press, by our guest, Dr. Jeremy Geffen. He's a board-certified medical oncologist. He is a fellow of the American College of Physicians, the founder of Geffen Visions International Incorporated. If you'd like to read more about them and about this subject, you can also go to their website, which is www.geffenvisions.com. And Dr. Geffen, thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you.